Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
I was duck hunting 3 days a week, and I was archery hunting 2 days a week, and then I was in grad school and track. More often than not, your hunts are usually more successful when you're just like out there like, yeah, it'll either happen or it won't. You know, either way is pretty good. You're just extreme nature walking. You're not actually hunting. The bus, you know, being kind of like that tiny house movement, like the nomadic, you know, the bus life thing. I think I've been able to reach a lot of people who maybe would not have even thought about public land issues in the beginning. My brother and I started a company called Public Land Tees. What certain legislators in the U.S. government are trying to package it as is a states' rights issue, and they're trying to transfer federally managed public land to the states, and so it would be state-managed land. Public land is literally the common ground that we share. So it's out there for everybody. It doesn't matter if you hunt or not. This is Sam Soholt, the public land bus guy. You are listening to Living Country in the City.
Y'all ready for your dose of flyover state spirit? Straight from the concrete jungle? Well, put down your latte and pull on your boots. It's time for Living Country in the City.
Hey, y'all, welcome to episode 87 of Living Country in the City. You know, as we're getting towards the end of the year, I'm looking back on a year and a half, almost 2 years of doing this podcast, and it's hard to believe how far it's grown, where it's come, and honestly, I still have trouble believing that any of y'all are still tuning in, but I just want to say a huge thank you to all of y'all that have been tuning in week after week, and some of y'all year after year at this point. During the times that it's a bit of a struggle getting the podcast out on time or scheduling time with guests or whatever it is, y'all make it really worth doing what I do. Really appreciate y'all and just wanted to say a big thank you. If y'all enjoy the podcast, you've been listening for a while, maybe you subscribed and really want to take the next step and be part of the Living Country in the City team, I'd ask that you check out my support page on livingcountryinthecity.com/support. You know, this is just a page that's really dedicated to ways that you can help out Living Country in the City. You know, this is a passion project for me. It will keep coming out week after week, regardless of whether you visit the page or not. But if you all have an interest in taking that next step, check out that support page. There's lots of different ways that you can really get involved. There's really, really simple stuff, whether that's sharing those podcast episodes with your friends or heading over to iTunes or Stitcher and leaving a rating and review. That actually helps a ton because it increases the podcast visibility and really helps it grow. There's a lot of other options, whether that's buying merch from store or from one of my affiliates, or even taking that next step and committing to a monthly contribution subscription on Patreon. The best part about those Patreon contributions is they come with some really awesome rewards. So once again, y'all, check that out, livingcountryinthecity.com/support. Also, a huge thank you to Sawyer Products for their support. They've been a big supporter of this podcast for quite a while now. I am a huge fan of their products, y'all. There is not a single hunt that I go on where I don't have at least one piece of their gear with me, whether that's sunscreen, insect repellent, first aid, or water filtration. There is something for every hunt in their lineup. It's that simple stuff that really keeps you in the outdoors for longer. So make sure y'all check them out at Sawyer.com. Now, on to today's episode. I am super excited to have this guy on the podcast. He is the man with the public lands plan, the owner of the Magic Public Lands Hunting School Bus, Sam Soholt. If y'all don't know who this guy is, you must have been living under a rock for the past year, but I'll let him tell the whole story. So I hope y'all enjoy today's episode. All right, welcome to another episode of Living Country in the City. Sam, thank you so much for hopping on the line today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. This is going to be fun.
I'm glad I was able to kind of catch you in a somewhat stationary position.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a moving target, so it's nice to have a few days in one location where I'm not actually in the school bus.
Oh, there you go. Well, we will get chatting about the school bus for sure, but just wanted to maybe have you introduce yourself and let my listeners know, just how did you get your introduction or your start in hunting and the outdoors?
Yeah, my main gig is a freelance photographer, but getting going into the whole hunting thing, I can't really remember a time where I wasn't involved in it growing up. And my dad was an avid hunter, and I was born in South Dakota, and so he used to be an archery hunter, and then when he had the three of us kids, he kind of gave up archery hunting because he wanted to spend time with the kids. And so the way to do that was to get us into bird hunting. And so we started in pheasant hunting and, probably started way too young. I think I was, maybe 5 or 6 when I started walking fields. And my dad will admit it that he burned me out on pheasant hunting at, too early. Cause I was just, like little kid trying to walk through CRP fields and stuff. It's your legs don't work all that well when you're walking through the grass. But he wanted to be close to us while he was hunting. And so we started in pheasant hunting. And then when I think my brother, who's older than me, I think he was 12, maybe a little bit old, doesn't matter. He got invited on a youth duck hunt, with another family. And so my dad was like, yeah, sure. So they went on a duck hunt, and it was like overnight we made the switch into full waterfowl hunting. And that was, I think I was maybe 8 or 9 when that kind of all transpired, and it went from, wearing tan cotton clothes that my dad had from back in the 70s and, like the old school camo, like onesies and, as many layers as you could possibly get on, to having, I think I got a lot of this from my dad, but when he decides that he wants to be passionate about something, it's not like he doesn't dabble. So it was like, I think we never got rid of any decoys. I think now we have like 30 dozen floating mallards. Jeez. And, at one point we had 7 or 8 duck boats and just piles of waders and clothing and parkas and, we all shot inexpensive Browning BPS because you could just beat the hell out of it, and then it kept going. But yeah, my start was in bird hunting, and then like pheasant hunting and then duck hunting. And then my brother moved to Wyoming for school because he wanted to learn how to elk hunt. And he kept telling me, I went to school because I wanted to be closer to duck hunting. So I chose North Dakota State because I knew I could duck hunt every weekend. And he kept telling me, he's like, you got to get into deer hunting, you got to get into elk hunting. And in 2009, I went out and I just filmed an elk hunt for him and his best friend. And we didn't even shoot an elk, but, we had elk bugling around us and had close calls and, spent a week in the mountains, and it was just awesome. And I drove the 14 hours back to Fargo, and I went into Shields the next day and I bought a bow. So that was the beginning of my archery hunting career. Was only about 8 years ago, but yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. I love hearing everyone's stories about hunting with their dads and the old camo and stuff like that, because that was an experience I didn't get. And I've seen pictures and I've kind of heard these stories, but it's cool for me to hear, because I we were talking a minute ago. I hopped into this 3 years ago, really. And it's funny. I relate to what you said about your dad, because I have no ability to go ease into things.
Yeah.
My very first hunt was a solo over the counter archery elk hunt.
That's awesome.
I literally. I mean, I'd sat in a tree stand once or twice before. I hesitate to really call those hunts. They were just me kind of fumbling around and eating Skittles in a tree stand. I have zero ability to just ease into something. So I completely relate to kind of going overboard. I'm afraid to actually start getting into. I picked up my first shotgun recently, and so I'm afraid to start getting into waterfowl.
Yep.
Because that's, whole other set of toys to buy. And
oh yeah, and there's so much more. Like, at least, if you look at solo backpack hunting, you have you can pretty much whatever you can fit in your backpack. Like, you can buy more than that, but you can't carry more than that.
Mm-hmm.
When you get into duck hunting, I mean, how many decoys can you fit in that truck? in college, I had a four-door Chevy Silverado, and so I had the short bed, and I was like, this is not nearly enough space for all the decoys I have. And so my college roommates and I, we made this, I'll have to find the picture and send it to you, but we made this makeshift truck bed extender that extended my pickup bed I think it was 6 feet beyond the tailgate being down. And it was just a wood 2x4 frame with some, makeshift plywood, and then had little braces and then a ratchet strap around the back. And then we had a broken decoy, and we cut the back end of the decoy off and screwed it to the back platform, and then spray paint on there just said swamp bound.
Oh, that's too good.
Yeah, no, it's, but the amount of gear that you can accumulate in the waterfowl world is just ridiculous.
I mean, like you said, even backpack hunting, yeah, there's only so much you can carry, but you got to try everything.
That's
you
right.
How else are you going to know what you want to carry right. in?
And, oh, yeah.
Oh, man. And there's just so many Black Friday sales and websites. And
I know. That's the problem.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. It's – but, yeah, no, I definitely feel that. And I love hearing, like I said, about just all those old stories. But, people hunting in the Walmart camo and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And
well, yeah. I mean, you coming into it this late, you're at a time where the gear is so much better. I mean, we were – the straight rubber waders and the old school camo. And, I'm trying to, it was a lot of it, or like army surplus, pants and shirt and, just cotton everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, if it even threatened to rain, you were wet. Yeah.
Yeah. It's definitely something that doesn't replace, skill in the field.
Yeah.
Gear does not replace. I mean, it will make you more comfortable.
Yep.
You have a better sight. It will help you. There's no concept. But I think so often, our focus on that is a big negative. Just because I kind of wish I had come up in that whole, just hunting in what I got kind of environment. And my nephew, I've been going out. I just recently moved up to Northern California, and I'm close to my nephews, and one of them, he's a big hunter. And that's what he does. He just, he's got some camo. He's got some gear that he's accumulated here and there just from different bits. But,
yep.
He doesn't let the fact that he doesn't have the latest First Light or Sitka or Kuyu pants.
Yep.
stop him from going out and trying to shoot whatever he can. I love that. And I've gotten more into that mindset, and I was never quite at the spot where it's just like, oh, I need the latest gear, but you know, I kind of wanted it.
Yep. Yeah.
I don't know. It's a tough thing. And I think we kind of hit this peak of, oh my gosh, we have all this gear and it's so good. And the marketing that's out there and it's so accessible from between Instagram and YouTube and all of this. But I think there's such a push now of reminding people to just go hunt, that you don't have to have that. I think we're kind of starting to come to a good equilibrium in there again.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually just did I was just on another podcast with, Aaron Snyder of Kafaru. Mm-hmm. And, we had the same conversation where there's been this huge push, you know, around like, you got to be the fittest guy, or you got to be, you know, you got to take this supplement, or you got to do this. And, you know, like, and we've kind of forgotten that, you're probably better off just knowing about the animal and what they do because you can have, you know, and I love using really good gear because I spend so many days in the field, but I also try to couple that with as much knowledge about the animal I'm chasing as possible.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, because without that, you're just a guy in a bunch of fancy gear.
You're taking the most expensive hiking camping trip.
That's right. Anyone can... You're just extreme nature walking. You're not actually hunting.
Extreme. I'm definitely using that that term from now on, extreme nature walking.
Yeah.
Because I definitely do a lot of that.
Don't we all?
I mean, it's funny. I'm like the prime example of that. I feel like, and it's not that I'm thinking like the gear will be an excuse of that. It's just more along the lines of I'm learning as I go and I'm getting the hell out there, but I still don't know nearly enough about what I'm doing. Cause you know, nothing really replaces those days in the field, but, I've taken a few extreme nature walks over the past, 2 years during September. My elk hunting experience has been very dramatic. First year involved two torn menisci in my knees. My second day out.
Jeez.
This last September involved going out with a buddy who I did an episode with him out in the field. We went out. He has llamas, and so we went out with the llamas and went into this little hellhole 7 miles deep. And I think we did over the course of 40 miles over a few days. We did 11,000 feet of elevation gain. It was just all vertical.
That sounds awful.
So, welcome to hunting. We're gonna kick your a bit, and but you know, hey, it's all after this, I figure it's all just like downhill. I got the worst out of the way.
Well, I definitely believe that so hunting is cumulative, right? So like or success is cumulative. So for every day you go out there and you fail, or not fail, but you don't succeed at, you know, like you don't complete the mission, which is, you know, notching a tag or whatever, and I think every day you don't get that done, you're one day closer to having it work. So, and then once you succeed, then that resets. And so it's, you know, the more, you know, sometimes you get lucky and you have an easy day or like an easy hunt, but,
I'm still waiting for that day, by the way.
Yeah. I have had exactly two of those days and they both came this year. So I think it was the cumulative for the past 4 years of very hard work where it all ended, you know, on that. So now I'm restarting. So
there we go. Yeah. Now you got to get the kickers in again. And
right. Yeah.
Oh man. No, I love it. It's, I don't know. You know, it's one of those things that everyone says it, but it really makes you appreciate it so much more. I think when you are successful, versus, you know, and don't get me wrong, if I saw a, you know, giant booner elk come, you know, cruising about 100 yards off the trail, I would not be too proud to shoot that animal.
Absolutely not. No. And you never should be. Like that.
Like, hey, man.
If I ever get to that point where I'm like, oh, that hunt wasn't hard enough, and I'm going to pass up an animal because I want, you know, to earn it more, just I should be done hunting.
What's it? Is it Ben O'Brien who talks about the hunting purity score?
So he didn't come up with it, but he's talked about it several times on the podcast. So I think it's one of the guys in the, I think it's Ranella's brother.
Okay.
With the purity score.
I think you're right, because I feel like I brought this up on another episode before with someone, and I think they said it belonged to Ranella's brother too. I'll have to sort it back and find that out, but.
And I appreciate that, you know.
Oh yeah.
But I do believe that I don't know Ranella's brother, and I don't know Ranella. Like, I mean, I've never met him in person, but I do think he's a glutton for punishment. I think he likes, I mean, just based on the show and, you know, what, like the types of hunts that he does. Like, I really think he likes that suffering to get to that successful point. Yep.
And there's something to be said for that. You know, it's.
Absolutely.
I don't know. Once again, it has to do with that whole jumping in with both feet to where, I don't know. I just never had the desire to really do an easy hunt. And it's funny, you know, like you said, a lot of people are like kind of your story where they started out in bird hunting and then kind of grew from there. I had zero desire to do any sort of bird hunting. I'm like, why would I ever want to hunt ducks or turkey or, you know, I mean, I didn't even think I'd be interested in like predator hunting, anything like that. And I feel like I'm the absolute opposite. I saw elk. I'm like, holy crap. That's all I care about in this world. And then the more I learned about elk hunting, it kind of swapped. And I'm like, oh, you know what? Turkey sounds kind of fun now. And I'm like, and then I went and bought a shotgun, and now I'm like, I wonder, you know, when I can go duck hunting with someone. And it's just a weird, like, flipped, kind of screwed up way to get into it. But I don't know, man. Hunting is just, there's nothing in this world like it, I feel like.
Well, it's just such a, I mean, it's been around, I mean, since the beginning of time that hunting's been around, but it's such a disconnect from everyday life. Like, it's just it's a way to get back to connecting to all the things that we are supposed to connect with.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not digitally, you know, not with this, but, you know, actually connecting with, you know, yourself and friends and family and nature. I mean, like, going back and getting into that kind of like that flow state of being focused on just that, the very moment that you're in.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. I was just recently out on a bear hunt with a buddy of mine that I met through Instagram, whatever. You know, that's one thing I love about this is, I'd say 90% of the people I've gone hunting with, I have no history, no background with. I'm just meeting strangers from the internet, and they're taking me out to remote places with guns. You know, it's awesome.
Right.
But, I just went out hunting with my buddy Jace. He lives up here in Northern California. We went out on a bear hunt, and, you know, we'd been out all morning, and we were kind of setting up camp for the evening. And we both just had this moment where we stopped and we kind of looked around and like, man, when's the last time you just like went camping and just kind of just chilled and enjoyed being out here with not even, I mean, you know, don't get me wrong. I love quote unquote camping with purpose.
Right.
But I was just enjoying, like, you know, we were kind of like done. We were done for the day, and we were just enjoying being in the outdoors and setting up camp and cooking and just shooting the shit and having a good time without having to stress about, do we need to get over that ridge tonight or, you know.
Right.
And I've realized, I'm like, I need to do that more. Every weekend is like, if I'm going out,
you're hunting.
I'm going hunting. And Which isn't a bad thing, but
Well, I think that's why, you know, backpacking or just general camping is so appealing and such a great thing for everyone to do, because the goal is just to spend time in the outdoors, right? So if that's your goal, you are succeeding at that goal every time you go camping. Whereas, you know, if you're hunting, camping is like just something you have to do to then complete this mission. And so, like you said, you just put all this pressure on yourself to, like, you know, complete this task that you've given yourself, and you start to lose focus on just, you know, enjoying it for what it is.
I think that was one of my big, one of the big things that I kind of did to myself on my first hunt was I put so much pressure on this one hunt. And because for me, it was so like I don't want to call it last minute, but it was January of, gosh, it seems like so long ago, but January of last year.
Yep.
I pretty much, you know, I'd kind of been interested in hunting, and I talked to a coworker of mine, and he was talking about elk hunting. He had, you know, he had seen, I had like a camo laptop cover on my laptop, and he was like, hey, yep, we need to talk. Because, you know, we both work in the music industry, and it's not the most, you know, LA music industry, not the most like hunting friendly environment.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of vegans in the office.
Yep.
And we actually run a very big vegan food and music festival. So it's, suffice to say, it's odd finding a kindred spirit in there. And so we were talking, and, you know, he had a picture of elk up, and he's talking about these elk hunts. And I'm like, oh, wow, you must have been doing this for a while. He's like, dude, you can do this every year. You can do this year if you want. And this was like in January.
Yep.
And so I'm like, okay, well, I better figure this out, because by September, I'm going to be in the woods trying to shoot an elk. I decided in that moment that was going to happen. And so, you know, I kind of got into it late, and I had just started the podcast. It wasn't even intended to be a hunting podcast, but it just kind of coincided with me falling in love with it, with hunting. And I was telling my story, and I had all of these people that kind of got vested in my story with me, and you know, were encouraging me and wanted to see me succeed. And I just put too much pressure on myself, not necessarily because of them, but I just wanted it to be successful so bad that I don't think I found ways to enjoy everything, all the little stuff in between. And I think that's important reminder for new hunters is,
and maybe this is just coincidence, but it seems like if you can keep yourself from getting like so tight, you know, about like, you know, I gotta kill this, I gotta get an elk, or I gotta get a deer, whatever. If you can keep yourself from doing that, and you stay a little bit more relaxed, more often than not, your hunts are usually more successful when you're just like out there like, yeah, it'll either happen or it won't, you know, either way is pretty good. Like, of course, I'll shoot something, but then, you know, like, I think when you're not, I don't know what it is, if you're not emitting like that stressful energy or whatever, like you just kind of relax into it and stuff starts to happen.
Well, I think you make better decisions too.
Yeah.
Where it's, you know, so often it's not even about necessarily like being too aggressive or taking too many risks, but you don't get into that mindset of like, you have to be doing things. And it's like, the animals are going to do what they're going to do. They're not going to follow your agenda. They're not going to.
Yep.
And I feel like, you know, so often when we're always on the move, always pushing, we don't take the time to observe enough around us. And when you're relaxed, I mean, I guarantee I've hiked and spooked hundreds of animals that I probably never even knew were within miles of me. I think it's just so important to kick back and just enjoy the hunt and figure it out. Let the animals kind of do their thing and find them where they're at.
Yep. Yep.
I want to ask you about the bus.
Yep.
So what took you from this guy that was going on, you know, photographing and filming elk hunts for your brother, going out buying your first bow and I guess becoming an addict,
yep,
to now you're a photographer, you're out on public lands, and you think to yourself, I'm going to buy a giant school bus. What happened? There's something happened in between there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a lot happened between between that and that. So I'll give a short synopsis of kind of how I got from buying my first bow to becoming a photographer. And then I'll do like another short synopsis of like becoming a photographer and then buying a full-size school bus.
Sounds good.
Okay. So yeah, drove home, bought a bow, started, because I was a student in North Dakota, you get a resident deer tag in North Dakota. And then I was also close to South Dakota. And I was able to get a resident deer tag in South Dakota that year. So this was fall of 2010. So I bought the bow, started shooting it. You know, I'm all excited about, you know, I'm getting better at shooting the bow and really want to hunt. My brother gave me a little bit of money. He's like, go buy a good tree stand because you're going to spend a lot of time in a tree. You're going to want a good tree stand. And so I went out and bought a good tree stand. And I literally knew nothing. I had gone, you know, rifle deer hunting a couple times over the course of the years, but not like I wouldn't call myself a big game hunter at that point. I knew literally nothing about trying to get close to a deer. So I bought all the gear, got a tree stand and some tree pegs and, had some, my grandma grew up in a little town in North Dakota and they had like 40 acres that she still owned that somebody else farmed. But there was like a little tree belt on it. And I was like, well, you know, whatever. It's like a spot to go hunt. And so I just went and hung a tree stand and started hunting and spent countless hours in this tree stand. And then through that, met a friend of my grandma's who had a bigger chunk of land. They're like, oh, yeah, we got way too many deer. Like, come shoot one. And so I bought a ground blind and went over and started sitting in a ground blind and then had planned anyway, that fall, I had started grad school. I was still duck hunting, like 3 days a week. Now, I mean, I'm far enough removed. I think I can say that without my parents getting mad because I didn't have college, but I was duck hunting 3 days a week and I was archery hunting 2 days a week. And then I was in grad school and track. So I was busy, but the rut kicked in. I went down to South Dakota. I put up a ground blind at the corner of this fence crossing. And a little forky came by at 20 yards and I shot him and it was in the evening. And so we just backed out and, came back the next morning and found him. And so now I've killed my first deer with my bow. I'm all fired up and I go back up to North Dakota. I go hunt. I just set up a ground blind one morning and a really nice buck walks by and I shot him. So within a week, I have now shot two bucks with my bow in my first season. And I am like, I think I forgot about life at that point. Like I was so jacked, that I was so excited and wanted to be part of kind of the hunting industry that I just started cold calling hunting shows and any email I could find, I'd send an email and any phone number I could find, I'd call. I mean, I probably called 40 different numbers and emails or whatever, and you try to get in touch with people. And one of them that I emailed was Midwest Whitetail. And, the host, Bill Winky, got back to me within an hour and he's like, oh yeah, we're always looking for interns. You know, why don't you come down during Christmas break and we'll chat and, you know, see if you're a fit. So I drove down to Southern Iowa over Christmas break and, got the job and got hired on a Midwest Whitetail and moved down there the next summer and was like, just, you know, oh, there's a fire, throw yourself into it. And so from, you know, September 1 to December 10th of that year, it was twice a day in a tree, you know, either filming or hunting and then editing in the middle of the day and then editing after dark. And from there, I moved to Colorado and produced a bunch of videos for my brother. My brother started a backcountry hunting store in Colorado. And so I was doing product overviews and all sorts of stuff for the shop. And then an opportunity came up to be a sales rep and moved to Montana. And I took the job and moved to Montana. And about a month after I had been there, I was in a coffee shop and heard a guy talking about video production. He was sitting next to me. And so I just struck up a conversation. I was like, what are you editing? And he's like, oh, I'm doing this thing for the Natural History Museum here in Bozeman. And he's like, but mostly what I do is I produce and edit a hunting show. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's what I do. You know, that's what I did. And just through that conversation, a couple weeks later, he was like, hey, I got a bear hunt that I need an extra camera guy on. You want to come? So I was like, of course. So I flew to Alaska, filmed a bear hunt. And then that led to another connection. And I actually quit my sales rep job and moved to Kodiak, Alaska, for about 5 months. And I filmed Coast Guard Alaska and a bear hunting show for the History Channel called The Hunt. And then it just started to snowball. So I just, through meeting people on the History Channel, I met somebody who worked for Remington, and they hired me to do a photo shoot for Remington. And then I met some writers, and they hired me to do a shoot for this. And then, you know, it just, one job after another just started, you know, connecting the dots and meeting more people. And every job led to the next. And next thing I knew, I was a photographer in the hunting industry. And just, you know, just through meeting the right people at the right time.
I want to say, I think that's kind of, I'm trying to remember how I first found your profile. And I think you went on I tend to get stories mixed up, and I'm going to apologize if this wasn't you. Did you end up going on a hunt and photographing for?
So through meeting all of these writers and editors through doing, I was shooting a lot of the new product seminars for Remington. So anytime they were coming out with new guns or whatever, they would, you know, bring 30 writers and editors down to try out the new product, and they needed a photographer. And so I would get hired for that. And I met a guy named Mike Scobie, who was at the time the editor of Peterson's Hunting Magazine. And I got a phone call one day from him and Ben O'Brien. And they're like, hey, we're taking Joe Rogan up to British Columbia on a moose hunt, and we need a cover shoot. And would you be interested in going? I was like, yep. So I flew up to British Columbia and spent a week with Ben O'Brien and Joe Rogan, and Rogan shot a moose. And we did a bunch of different photos, and, you know, they ended up choosing the one where he's holding the moose leg over his shoulder. And that was the kind of the beginning of like the, you know, the wild game meat, you know, eat what you kill movement. That was definitely, my biggest photo up to that point that really launched, you know, me in the industry. And when that hit shelves, it made a big splash just because of, you know, who the character was, who Joe is as a person, you know, on the cover of a hunting magazine. You know, all of a sudden it was picked up by a lot of different people. And, I think that did definitely help my start.
Visibility a little bit.
Yes. Yes. So that was the big one there. And then just kept, you know, working with different companies. I did while I was kind of off and on doing freelance photography, I was doing a big tour with Yeti, going to trade shows and talking about Yeti coolers, and did that whole thing. And then, yeah, it's just kind of, I'm a true believer that every job leads to the next. And so I just would meet as many people as I possibly could and tried to stay connected with them. And it seemed like more often than not, somebody would, you know, just at a time when I would not have anything going on, I'd get a phone call that was like, hey, need you for this, you know? Okay. So just go off and do that. But, that all, you know, ended up being longer than I wanted to say, but
that's the nice thing about podcasts is, you know,
yeah, you kind of just keep meandering. So then the bus, it's kind of funny. So the bus idea actually started before I ever did the shoot with Rogan. My brother and his business partner and I were talking, just sitting around kind of bullshitting and talking about, you know, cool ideas and what you could do with different hunting vehicles. And we were talking about, we were like, we should get a school bus and do like a 10 or 12 state turkey hunting tour. You know, you rip the guts out and then we can go turkey hunting, and you have a place to live and it's pretty high clearance and you can get down dirt roads and you can just go like pop out and go hunt turkeys. And then we could turn it into this kind of like, you know, maybe turn it into like a marketing vehicle for the shop and, you know, do hunts out of it and blah, whatever. And, but, you know, nobody ever did anything about it. And so it was always in the back of my head that it would still be super cool to build out a school bus. And there was a couple times where I would start to research them, and I even test drove one or two, and then I just never bought anything. And when everything started happening around the 2016 election, and there was a lot of talk about public land issues and the possibility of land transfer and, you know, a threat to losing all of these places where guys like you and me can just buy an over-the-counter tag and go out and spend time in the outdoors, you know, all that was possibly on the chopping block. It just kind of coincided with the bus being basically a giant billboard to be able to get this message across about public lands. And I just, when all of this was happening, I just felt super compelled to, you know, kind of be another voice in the industry and kind of get people talking about it more. And so people were speaking up and, you know, doing things for conservation and raising money for public land lobbying and what have you. But it just, all the timing was perfect. And I just went on Craigslist, and my brother actually found the bus in Colorado. And I'm a big fan of bartering. And so I tried to barter with the guy for gear first. I was like, yeah, do you hunt or fish? You know, he's like, yeah, we do. I was like, oh, what gear do you need? You know? And so I was trying to trade like guns and coolers and gear, like clothing, all sorts of stuff. And I think I just wore him out, and he was like, all right, I'll take $5,000 worth of gear trade or $3,500 cash. And so I just was like, I'll take it for $3,500.
How many Yeti coolers equals a school bus?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's roughly 10 if you get it for $3,500.
Wow, that many. You must be getting those on sale.
But yeah, so I picked it up for $3,500 and bought it on New Year's Eve 2016. And then it sat behind my brother's shop for a couple months before I drove it back to South Dakota to do the build. Yeah, and then I did the whole build the summer of 2017.
It's so funny because it feels like, I don't know, it seems like you just always had it. Like, yeah. It's one of those weird things where, and you say that, I'm like, gosh, I guess, yeah. And I think back and watching you do the build online, you know, all the posts and everything, and yep. I'm like, I guess it really wasn't all that long ago that you did all of this.
Yeah, I guess coming up on 2 years that I've owned the bus. And it, I've certainly spent a lot of time in it over the past 2 years, which is great.
Well, it's become such a part of your identity, I feel like, now.
Yeah, no, it definitely has. And it was pretty cool because in the beginning, you know, I bought the bus, and then I took it home, and I started to, or home, you know, whatever place I could park it, and took it back and, started to do the build, and was, you know, posting about it on my Instagram story and, you know, letting people follow along. And Rogan actually sent me a message, and he was like, dude, the bus looks awesome. You know, like, what are you doing? And we had a hunt planned, down in Hawaii where he was going to be on. I was like, oh yeah, I'll tell you all about it when I get down to Hawaii. You know, he's like, sweet, you know, sweet. Like, I can't wait, you know. And then ended up being on one of his podcasts, and he was like, all right, you got to tell me about the bus. And so I talked to, you know, for about 30 seconds on the podcast on there, talked about the bus, and he was like, all right, you know, and he pushed people to my page, and it was a huge bump, you know, right in the beginning of the build. And that really, you know, fueled the fire for people following along and kind of getting the ball rolling. But, you know, I don't know how good of a job I've done, but I like to think at least a little bit, you know, people are talking more about public lands because of the bus, and, you know, or at least questioning like what the hell's going on. And that was the whole goal with the project, was to just have this big, like, you know, this big thing for people to focus on. And then I could be talking about different public land things. And then people could go do their own research and figure out, you know, try to figure out what's going on and get involved. I like to think it's helped.
No, I think it's, you know, and especially with someone like Rogan pushing his audience, you know, I feel like so many hunters, you know, there's definitely this group of hunters that are just kind of like, you know, they're off doing their own thing, whatever. But I feel like so many hunters now are educated on public lands and pushing for it, that, you know, you're just talking in your own echo chamber when you're preaching to them. But yep. So often when you have someone like Rogan pulling in all these people that are either just learning about hunting or not interested in it at all, but want to see what he's talking about, you know, because people worship that dude.
Right.
I feel like it's such a, you know, it's such a unique way to get people in, and it's definitely a conversation starter. And it's cool having him push those new hunters that way and have them start out in this, this world. So
I've tried to do everything that I can to reach an audience that, because if we talk to each other, you know, we've got all the problems solved, but we're a very small group when it comes down. And so I've tried to do whatever I can to reach people that aren't necessarily, you know, in that crowd that already knows about the public land thing. So I think that the bus, you know, being kind of like that tiny house movement, like the nomadic, you know, the bus life thing, I think I've been able to reach a lot of people who maybe would not have even thought about public land issues in the beginning.
And I feel like, I mean, I know you've inspired a lot of people because, you know, it's like I said, it's become somewhat part of your identity. And, for sure. You know, I mean, you're the bus guy. And I mean, you've even had me thinking about, like, we talked a bit earlier, you know, I kind of spent 2 months during hunting season just on the road. And I was thinking to myself, I'm like, you know, I see the appeal of this and a little bit how he does it. And I will admit I spent some time on Craigslist. I wasn't going full bus route for sure, but I was like, you know, I had a buddy that like retrofitted a panel van for, he would go do shooting competitions all over the US and he just retrofitted this panel van so he could rack all his guns in a safe in there, and you know, he had a shelves and a sleeping plate. I'm like, you know, I could do something like that. Do like a little mini version of my own, and I guarantee I'm not the only person who's thought about that. And
I know one thing is for sure. I've had a ton of people reach out about also buying school buses, and I have probably talked more people out of buying a school bus than I have talked them into buying a school bus. And it's for what I'm doing with it and what I want, my goal, like with the whole project, a school bus is the perfect vehicle. And I'll be honest, it's a pretty nice hunting camp. But if I always tell people, if your goal is to just get out there and spend more time in the outdoors, don't buy a school bus. get a camper or a van or a, you know, whatever.
I imagine it's not the easiest to get over rutted backcountry roads deep in mud or
even a little bit. It's terrible in anything soft. You know, any mud, it's not good. My new tires are a little bit better, but it's still, you know, almost 20,000 pounds. And so you're, you know, if you get a bus stuck in the middle of somewhere, it's just not that easy to get out. Luckily, I haven't done that yet. But
I'm sure the gas mileage is just great too on that.
Unbelievable gas mileage. Yeah.
It's like anywhere. Move over Prius.
Yeah.
You've got the public land school bus.
Yeah. I get anywhere from, depending on the wind, I get anywhere from about 6 to 9.5. So.
The funny thing is, I think I'm pretty sure my old Jeep Wrangler did not get much more than that with what I did to it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Oh, man. It's just at that point, you're pretty much driving from gas station to gas station and just making pit stops in between.
Luckily, it has a 60-gallon tank, which is, you know, I can get quite a ways. And actually, it was pretty cool. So last year, you know, I went to a couple different trade shows before I did the build, and I was like, you know, talking to companies and being like, hey, I bought a school bus and this is what I'm doing with it. You know, and I got a bunch of people fired up about, you know, kind of being part of the project and kind of help pushing it out there. And, I just ended up self-sponsoring the whole thing last year. But after a year of doing it and, you know, seeing, you know, the impact of what I've had on people and talking about public lands and conservation, I've been fortunate to have companies that want to come on board and like help further that message and kind of add fuel to the fire. And one of the companies that I've been working with now is Mountain Ops, and they came on board to literally fuel the bus. So the bus is fueled by Mountain Ops, which is pretty great because they're huge fans of what I'm up to, and they want to be, you know, they wanted to be part of it from, you know, the first time I talked to them this year, and they're like, how do we help you? And I was like, honestly, guys, like, I need diesel fuel. Like, how do we work together? How do we work together to have the bus fueled by Mountain Ops? And so they've been gracious enough to come on board, and they're helping me pay for diesel so I can be out there spreading the public land message more than I ever have been able to.
That's awesome. Yeah, I saw, I think I can't remember if I saw it on their profile or yours. There's a bow package being given away as well.
Unfortunately, I think that sale or that deal has ended. I think it was just kind of that Black Friday.
Oh, was that one of the Black Friday deals? I remember. I just saw it flash by. I couldn't remember when I saw it. So
yeah, they did it over Thanksgiving weekend. So if you know people were using my code, they were able to win a bow. I think bow, some Vortex stuff, and then some Sitka stuff. So it was a kind of like a $1,300 package, which was pretty cool.
I have to say, I love the. I think I've all the giveaways, you know, everyone does giveaways and stuff. And I think on all the ones, whatever I've bought something for, I've entered, I've won, I think a hat and a beer koozie.
Yep.
But I don't know. I love seeing the excitement over gear and people winning stuff. And it's just fun to see, you know? And oh, a bow Sam Soholt touched. It must be magical and lucky, right? That's how it works.
That's how it works. Yeah. I infuse my mojo onto that bow, you know.
the public lands bus mojo. So I want to give you a chance to do a little shameless plug. What is that you're wearing right now?
That's great.
Nobody can see, so we'll need you to describe it.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So the in addition to building the bus and touring around and talking about public lands, my brother and I started a company called, you know, easily enough, Public Land Tees. And so we started an apparel company to raise money for public land conservation. And it's just $5 from every shirt. And $5 from every shirt goes to conservation organizations. And coming up in December, we're actually doing something called I just came up with this week. We're just, you know, rolling this out. But we're doing something called Conservation Christmas for the entire month of December. And so in the past, we've done all of the money has gone to one organization. And in December, we are picking and choosing certain shirts. The money is going to go to, we're spreading the wealth a little bit, and we're going to go to spread money around to different conservation organizations, depending on which shirt you buy. Yeah, so trying to end 2018 with a huge bang as far as raising money for conservation and public land protection. And anybody can find either. Right now we've got just shirts and stickers, and then we've got some Yeti mugs coming with some of our designs on them in December, so we'll be able to launch those here pretty quick. But yeah, it's going to be, I think December is going to be a big month for raising money and helping keep public lands public.
That's awesome, man. Yeah, I'll make sure, you know, I'll post up on the show notes page and in the description a link to that. It's just publiclandtees.com, T-E-E-S.
Yep, publiclandtees.com.
Awesome. Yeah, I will make sure we're sending what little traffic I can send your way.
All of it helps, you know. The more eyes on it, the better, you know. And I always think that if, you know, one person goes and checks out the site and they're like, oh, I like that design, and then, you know, even if they don't buy it, they might tell a buddy about it. I mean, it's just more is more. And, you know, last year we gave a little over a $2,000 check to Backcountry Hunters and Anglers at the BHA Rendezvous. And we are on track again this year to do another big donation to them. And then hopefully through the month of December, we'll be, you know, sending money all over the place.
So do you know when people need to kind of get in their orders if they want to throw that on their Christmas list?
You know, let's see. It's not hunting any season anymore, so we'll probably be a little quicker on shipping.
I know how that goes.
I would say, you know, anytime before the, 18th or 19th, which should be able to get stuff out for Christmas.
All right. So, y'all get it on your Christmas list. Get them over to mom and dad. Say, I want public land tees for Christmas.
That's right. That's right. And I think we're going to try to put together a couple little like Christmas bundles too that people can buy and save a little bit of money and still donate a bunch of money to conservation. So
that's awesome. Yes, definitely. We'll be posting that up on the show notes page. This will be, what episode will this be? 87, I think.
Cool. So, I really appreciate
No, absolutely. Glad to do. You know, I've tried to spread the word as much as I can, and you know, I love supporting other companies that are doing great stuff for public lands, and I'm trying to, you know, with the little bit, you know, the one hat I sell every 6 months, I try and donate a little bit of every purchase to that. So I'm always game to push anyone supporting public lands. I'm always game to push to that message. So
cool.
On that note, let's take a quick second to hear a word from one of my partners. All right, y'all, I'm not afraid to admit that I'm a huge geek when it comes to games. And well, let's face it, a lot of other things too. However, when it comes to nerdy card and board games, I really can't get enough. So when I found out there was a card game out there combining two of my passions, hunting and nerdy adventure games, I really had to pick it up. The game is called Gut Pile, and the goal is to build the ultimate Alaskan hunt. You do so by collecting several cards, including animals such as grizzly bear and moose, hunting locations like Yonder Mountain and Nunya Creek, as well as weaponry, gear, and transportation. But make sure you've got tags or donuts handy, because you never know when an Alaskan state trooper will drop in unannounced. It's a great game and a ton of fun for hunters who are inspired to share stories about their past hunts, as well as non-hunters who can be brought into discussions about hunting in a very non-threatening way. If you'd like to learn more, check out my podcast with the guys at Gutpile Games by visiting livingcountryinthecity.com/22 and get $5 off your order from Gutpile Games by visiting our partners page at livingcountryinthecity.com/partners. So what would you say, you know, we talked a little bit about everything surrounding the election, but what would you say, somebody that's, you know, just coming in, you know, someone that maybe found you from Rogan's podcast, or somebody that may just be starting and be like, okay, you know, I know what public lands are, but I guess kind of a twofold question. Why is this all such a big deal? And what do I need to know? Like, what's the important, like the first few things that I need to wrap my head around about these issues?
Yeah. So I think it's important. I always try to remind people that I think the majority of people out there know that public land exists, but I think most of us have framed it in our mind in a way where, okay, that's just public land, but you don't think about what that means. So public land are places that you and I and everybody else owns collectively. So because we are taxpaying individuals, like money from our taxes goes towards maintaining that land. And then it's open for use for all of us. And obviously there's some places that have certain restrictions on access and that type of thing. But public land is collectively owned by the people. And I think it's really important for people to remember that, because it's not federal land. It's federally managed land. And it's not state land. It's state managed land. And I like to remind people of that. And then what people need to know is the biggest issue there's a lot of big issues, but one of the biggest issues right now is people trying to do land transfer. So this is a very shortened version of it, but what certain legislators in the U.S. government are trying to package it as is a states' rights issue. And they're trying to transfer federally managed public land to the states, and so it would be state-managed land. But the problem with that is when land goes to the states, states need to make money off of the land. So whether that be access fees or resource extraction or grazing rights, or, you know, there's a multitude of things that they could lease it out for. If the state cannot make money on the land, a lot of times it will either be closed to access so they don't have to maintain it, or it will be sold off. And so it's just a fast track to losing access to the land that we have access to. if it stays federally managed, and there are definitely problems with how things are managed, but a lot of that has to do with budget cuts and funding for the, you know, the agencies that are supposed to manage the land. But if you keep it at the federal level, it doesn't, the land doesn't have to make money from the land. Like it'll stay open to the public. And it's an important issue. Economically, the outdoor industry is an 800 and, almost $1 trillion industry, or no, almost a hundred, I guess. Yeah. Almost $1 trillion industry, $887 billion industry. That is, the cornerstone of that is public land. And, if that, all of that starts to become privatized, you start to lose out on all of those things that everyone can go do.
It's one of those things I think a lot of people don't understand because they come from the world of, I got this plot of land that I hunt and lease, why shouldn't everyone do that? And I think there's a lot of just people that can't necessarily relate. For me, it's so important because I don't have access to that. And I wanted to start elk hunting. I'm here in California and, we got elk that nobody else right. has, but, it's going to be a decade if I ever get to hunt those elk. But having the opportunity to just go out and buy a tag and be able to do what I'm passionate about, that's the only way I'm going to be able to do it is with public lands.
Well, and I think it's important to say to people like, so guys like you and me, like we look at all of this stuff through the lens of hunting. Mm-hmm. Okay? So we have the filter of hunting always, like that's how we see the world, or, at least public lands. But regardless of what public land user group you fall under, so whether you're a ATV enthusiast or a hiker or a biker or a, you ride horses or you backpack, or you are a birder or, you fly fish or whatever you do, like I put this in a post, but public land is literally the common ground that we share. So it's out there for everybody. It doesn't matter if you hunt or not. It's we all have it to lose.
Yeah, it's a very important distinction, I think, when people, when we put out that message, like you said, we look at it a lot through the lens of hunting. But I've definitely talked with a lot of people, and I'm like, hey, this is I was trying to organize, I think, something for BHA, and I'm like, well, the group's backcountry hunters and anglers, but it focuses on public land access for everyone, whether, regardless of what you want to do. If you want to go out and hike and take photos of the deer, or if you want to go out and try and shoot them, it doesn't matter. It's, and I've brought up the idea of Pittman Robertson with people. I'm like, yeah, that's money that basically it comes from hunting, comes from hunters solely. Like yep. that's not something that anyone else is putting into, unless you're buying that hunting gear, unless you're, buying those tags. But it provides access to absolutely everyone, regardless of how you want to use that public land. So I've gotten into that with people. I'm like, you may hate what I do, what I'm passionate about, but you reap the benefits of it.
What you'd like to do. No, and we could go down a lot of rabbit holes, but at this junction, we need to start talking about the outdoor industry and how at some point they need to get a little skin in the game. And it was a while back that they tried to pass the backpack tax. The outdoor industry didn't try to pass it, but the mm-hmm. legislature tried to pass it. And they fought it hard because it's, it would be a similar tax to the Pittman-Robertson Act or the Dingell-Johnson Act. But it would be on all camping and outdoor gear. But they fought that hard. But at some point we're going to, it's just going to need to happen if we want to maintain the number, the amount of access that we currently have, because just gun sales and ammo sales and, archery gear and fishing gear, like it's not going to maintain it forever.
Yeah. And people are going to, people are going to find someone to blame, and they're not going to take responsibility. Just, I know that's how our world works, and we start losing this, they're going to look at a scapegoat and never take the time to sit and think, I could have done something about this, you know. And that's what frustrates me more than anything else about it is the lack of, I don't know, I don't want to say personal responsibility, but I don't know, just willingness to put yourself out there. And that's what I admire about so many people in the hunting industry and this push that's being made now. Just taking responsibility for keeping what we love.
And just, you know, keeping what we love and protecting it for future generations.
So, as we're kind of winding down here, I always like to finish up, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about this podcast is really focused on people that may not have a deep background in hunting, may not have grown up doing it, or even just folks that are from an environment that may not be as accessible to hunting. And if someone came up to you and said, hey, you know, I've been following you, I'm super interested in the outdoors and hunting and this whole thing, and I don't know where to start. There's so much to learn. It's too much. It's too intimidating. I don't have the resources to do this. What advice or words of encouragement would you give that person?
Yeah. So, I was thinking about that at the beginning. And I think the best way to tell people to, if they want to get into it, is do the opposite of what you did. So I think we have a hard time with hunter recruitment because, you know, so there's a lot of people that people aspire to be, you know, there's a lot of guys in the industry who do these huge adventure hunts and, you know, and even you just like going solo, like just going in and doing like the big adventure elk hunt. If you don't have a certain personality to go into that and fail and still want to do it again, it's probably not the best place to start. And growing up, I started small. So, you know, it was always, you know, it was birds, you know, to begin with for sure. But, you know, when I was really little, I'll admit it, it was smaller birds, you know, and a BB gun. Don't start there because it's probably not technically legal a lot of the time. But
a lot of sparrows missing from my backyard as a kid.
Yeah. I would just encourage people to start smaller and don't necessarily don't dive into a deer hunt or don't dive into an elk hunt right away. Test the waters with pheasants or ducks or quail or whatever, because you can usually find people who are more willing to take you into a spot to go chase ducks or go chase pheasants or go, you know, shoot quail or, you know, walk around behind the dogs and do that whole thing, or go on a rabbit hunt, or go on, you know, go chase squirrels in the woods, you know, do all of these things. That's a much smaller, and it gives you kind of an introductory course on learning how animals work and how, you know, strategy with, you know, chasing certain game. And once you start to learn that on a smaller level, you can apply all of that to, okay, now I want to go deer hunting, or now I want to go antelope hunting, or now I want to go elk hunting. And I can see how it would be incredibly intimidating to get into it if you've never done it, but just, you got to, you know, find somebody who does and reach out to them and see if they would be willing to take you on your first hunt. Cause there's, you know, most of the time, maybe not most of the time, but you're going to find somebody who would be willing to share the experience. And don't be scared. I mean, like, you know, like we all started, you know, in one way or another, you just gotta be willing to ask.
Now, I think that's important once again, do not do what I did. Like you said, it takes a certain type of slightly demented personality. I added the demented just because I know myself.
I mean, you can do that. You just know that it's probably not going to pan out the way you fantasize about it in your head the first time. Yeah.
that was the one, the biggest thing. I honestly knew there was a vague chance it could happen, but I did not really go into that expecting to be like, I'm going to take this giant bull elk
and that's probably why you're still so addicted to it.
Yeah. I knew there's a remote chance, and I hoped for it, but I wasn't sure how much I expected it to actually happen. The one thing that was a surprise for me that I was kind of disappointed is, like, I wanted that adventure hunt experience, though.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to be hearing the bugling bulls and this and that. And to be completely honest, I didn't get any of that. I hiked in. It was miserable. A snowstorm blew in. I didn't hear a blessed thing. I saw absolutely nothing. It was awful. I'm like hiking on a torn meniscus, and oh my gosh, it was a disaster. Yeah. And that was what surprised me. And it's like, that was a lesson I learned. You're not always going to even get that, you know. Yeah. Sometimes it's just going to be a miserable lot, and so you got to find ways to enjoy it. But it's very important. And you know, like we talked about, I kind of did the flip, and now I'm learning to enjoy those small hunts and learning so much just from sitting out with a shotgun trying to call in coyotes. And
yep
got my first deer this year, got a fox this year, and it's just been fun, exciting, and I've had an incredible time out with my buddies hunting. And so I think, you know, find some guys, like you said, find someone that'll take you. Trust me, I will point you in the email me, you know, email pretty much any of my guests, and I'm sure they can point you to some people that will, we have access to so much technology, Facebook groups, how many countless, you know, I mean, hop on your local BHA group. That's where I tell people to start. First and foremost, go on Facebook, find your state's BHA group. Pretty much every state has one. They're all named completely differently. So they're sometimes a little hard to find, but you know, somebody will point you in the right direction, and, you know, hop on there. You know, there's apps, there's the Go Wild app, you know, where people are super responsive, and I've never seen more people willing to help a person out than on that app in the world. But so much access to technology to find people. There's no excuse anymore, you know?
Yeah. Just, you know, it's once you just get over the fact that you're probably a little intimidated and just go do it.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if people wanted to find you on the interwebs, follow along with all the adventures, where are they looking?
Best spot is either, well, probably just Instagram is probably the best spot. So just my Instagram, just my name, at Sam Stoholt.
All right. And then publiclandtees.com to load up on Christmas swag. Can't even say that right now. Christmas swag.
Yep.
Send public land tees to all your friends that will get them and be like, what the heck is this? What public lands? And you got a conversation starter right
there.
That's right. That's right. Like, you're going to get a gift. Ask me questions. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking the time. I had a really good time chatting with you, man.
Yeah, me too. Thanks for having me on.
All right, y'all, that'll do it for episode 87 of Living Country in the City. Big thank you to Sam for taking the time out of his day to hop on the podcast. Make sure y'all head on over to our show notes page at livingcountryinthecity.com/87. Check out everything we talked about in today's episode. Also, make sure you hit that website, check out the support page, that's livingcountryinthecity.com/support. Help take a little chip out of the work involved in running this podcast. But in the meantime, keep it country, y'all.
Thank y'all for listening to Living Country in the City. Get show notes and check out the blog, product reviews, events, and more at livingcountryinthecity.com.
Join me, Chef Jean-Paul Bourgeois, and the whole crew here at Duck Camp Dinners every Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV. Birds up in the sky. Through the Blackwater Bayous and in the dark Louisiana night, floats a duck camp, alive with the sounds of swamp pop and the smells of Cajun cooking. From the Mississippi Delta in Venice to the Cajun prairies of the Southwest, me and the Duck Camp Dinners crew will be hunting and eating it all.
This is Duck Camp Dinner.
Join me, Chef Jean-Paul Bourgeois, and the whole crew every Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV.